Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week we'll be joined by David Farris. He's a political scientist at Roosevelt University, and he has a new book out. It's called It's Time to Fight Dirty, How Democrats Can Build a Lasting Majority in American Politics. He in that book, he suggests that Democrats fight fire with fire. You know, there's an inherent tension in liberalism right now, which is that we many folks on the left side of the spectrum want to defend the norms that have made these sometimes creaky institutions work for 230 years, but we're dealing with people who are using those institutions to consolidate their own power. They're gaming the system, a system that was designed to be clunky and not always terribly democratic. And Farris's argument is like, you know, you gotta fight fire with fire. That's the theme of his book. Anyway, then we're going to be joined by Evan Weber. He's a co-founder of the Sunrise Semester, the Sunrise Movement, and they're putting together a program to train young activists to get out there and fight to defend the climate, the planet. Finally, we're going to play an old interview from last year with Jeffrey Swanson. He's a professor of psychiatry at Duke, about a fascinating study about gun ownership among people with impulsive anger issues, anger control issues. Stay tuned. We have a big show, so we'll take a quick break and come right back.
Has a beard. Running to me a crying when it throws you out. Running to me a crying on your own again. You got that pure feel. Such good responses, but the picture has a mustache. You come into me with that soulful look on your face. You come in looking like you never ever done one wrong thing. Has a beard.
Welcome back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by David Farris. David is the program director of political science at Roosevelt University, and he's the author of a new book titled It's Time to Fight Dirty, How Democrats Can Build a Lasting Majority in American Politics. David, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks for having me on the show, Josh.
Thanks for taking the time. So we're dealing with a structural imbalance, an asymmetrical political war, if you will. Democrats, and I think liberals more broadly, are trying to defend institutional norms that have long made our clunky system of government more or less functional, and I'll stress more or less. And their opponents appear willing to do anything to exercise and maintain power, including riding roughshod over those very norms. In essence, you're calling for Democrats to fight fire with fire. Is that right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think we've seen an escalating process of institutional and procedural warfare being used against us over the last 20 years. And I think it's long past time that Democrats and the left more broadly started to understand what was happening to them and to use the powers that they will have the next time they're in power to fight back in kind.
Now, I listeners to this show are pretty familiar with some of the undemocratic moves that the Republican Party has undertaken in recent years. We've spoken to the authors of that UC San Diego study about strict voter ID laws and how it suppresses the vote of Democrats by 8.8% and Republicans by 3.6%. We talk about California having the same number of Senate seats with millions and millions of people as a tiny state like whatever, Wyoming or Montana. What are the main things that you're looking at as far as the way that Republicans have rigged the system?
Sure. Well, you know, in some cases, Republicans have rigged the system. In some cases, the institutions are kind of stacked against us based on how the Constitution is written and it's been interpreted. I think the most outrageous example of institutional warfare was the Merrick Garland fiasco. Every time I think about that, it makes my blood boil. But
me too.
It's just outrageous. I mean, they stole a seat on the Supreme Court. And they did so because the Constitution is not specific enough about what advice and consent means. And so there you have a very good example of Republicans finding a kind of a loophole in the Constitution and then exploiting it really ruthlessly when they had the opportunity. Look at it more broadly. As you note, these voter ID laws, it's not just the voter ID, but it's also things like felony disenfranchisement laws, all of which together have the impact of driving down Democratic turnout significantly. And they do this really unapologetically. You know, in some cases, they've been caught on tape, you know, talking about how these laws were intended to drive down turnout for Democrats. And
yeah,
I think the gimmick of the book is that a lot of the things that drive us most crazy about our political system are not written into the Constitution at all. The Constitution doesn't say have much to say at all about voting rights. And so the reality is that a lot of these problems are vulnerable to a dedicated Democratic majority rewriting the laws and playing hardball. And so that's, you know, fighting dirty really means leveling the playing field, you know, fighting back in kind, passing a national voting rights act that'll eliminate these voter ID laws, that will restore voting rights for all ex-felons, that will create a national voting holiday, it'll automatically register all Americans to vote. This is low-hanging fruit. You know, I mean, this could be done within a month the next time the Democrats take power. And so the book is kind of a call to arms. You know, we need to get smart about these things. We need to fight, and we need to level the playing field. And I think we can defend these things as a project to improve the long-term performance of American democracy overall, build trust in the system.
Yeah. David had a brief drop out there, and he was talking about making a national holiday for voting. Right now, although many states have early voting, election day is on a Tuesday, and that means that a lot of people who are work for a living have a hard time taking it off, and you know, other countries vote on Saturday and Sunday. So let's talk about a few specifics. Let's say hypothetically that the blue wave that we're all looking at, that we're all hoping for, materializes in November, and then Trump loses in 2020. 2020 will also be a year when Senate Republicans face a lot of exposure. It's the kind of inverse of 2018. So let's say Dems end up in January 2021 with the White House and solid majorities in both chambers of Congress. What are you proposing they do other than the things that we've already discussed?
Sure. Well, I think one of the first things they're going to have to do, unless they win a supermajority in Senate, is to eliminate the filibuster. You know, I think the filibuster is sort of anti-democratic relic of a bygone age. And I don't think it's justifiable from a democratic theoretical perspective, even right now. So once they get rid of the filibuster, they can do all kinds of things. The first of which should be granting statehood to Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico, which is a, the situation in those places is just outrageous from a Democratic spalty Democratic perspective. They don't have voting representation in Congress. In D.C., they don't have really control over the city budget. And these are states that would easily send four Democratic senators to D.C. It would instantly change the strategic balance in the Senate. If we had done this already, we'd have the Senate right now. And we would not have to worry about Ruth Bader Ginsburg's health or Anthony Kennedy's health. We could just stonewall Trump and return the favor from Merrick Garland and not approve any of his nominees. So it would really be a huge help in terms of rectifying what I see as a structural imbalance for the left in the Senate, because there are probably 29 or 30 states that lean Republican and 20 or 21 that lean Democratic, and in a vacuum, you take this sort of monumental incompetence and stupidity of the Trump administration out of the picture. I think that Democrats are going to lose the Senate more often than they win it going forward, and they have to do something about that. And so D.C. and Puerto Rico, that's low hanging fruit that could be done in weeks. A sort of a longer term project, I think, would be to really seriously think about breaking California up into six or seven pieces, instead of sending two senators for the 38 million people of California, we could send 14. It would change the math in the Electoral College, and it's also not unconstitutional. It would be a heavier lift. It would take longer. This is not a day one thing, but I think it's something the party needs to get serious about. If so much of the energy on the left is in California, it's kind of bottled up right now in those two Senate seats. So those are a couple of things. I think we also need to really think hard about how we elect the House of Representatives. Last year, Republicans won the national popular vote for the House by a point, but still had this huge seat majority. It's not the first time that's happened. In 2012, Democrats won the national popular vote for the House, and they still lost the chamber dramatically. So I have a plan in there about how to sort of move the whole country past these destructive gerrymandering battles, create larger districts, increase the size of the House, and all of which would, I think, make the results of those elections more proportional, make it harder for Democrats to win popular votes but lose control of the chamber. I think it would invite third, fourth, and fifth parties into the process in a more meaningful way than they are now. And that also is a day one thing. The Elections Clause of the Constitution clearly gives Congress the right to set and alter policies for federal elections. So there's nothing stopping us from doing that except a sort of lack of imagination and a lack of will. I'd probably start with those things in the Voting Rights Act. And then there's a court piece here too. I don't know if you want me to talk about that now, but think of it as like kind of a blitzkrieg on the first 3 months of the next Democratic administration, assuming they have control of Congress, could really take some important steps to level the electoral playing field moving forward.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with David Ferris about his book, It's Time to Fight Dirty. Let me play devil's advocate here. You mentioned the courts. I think probably the most controversial, or arguably the most controversial thing you call for, is packing the Supreme Court to get a progressive majority. By the way, it's a progressive majority that the court should have. Merrick Garland would have been the tipping point that would have given the court its first liberal majority since 1973. That's how consequential Mitch McConnell's sabotage or theft of that Supreme Court seat was. And I do mean that I'm playing devil's advocate, because I tend to agree with you that the Dems need to bring a gun to a gunfight. The question is, where does it end? So you pack the courts, that recovers a Supreme Court seat that was stolen when Mitch McConnell blocked Merrick Garland for a year. Doesn't that give the next Republican president and Congress a precedent for doing the same thing? Or if both parties stop respecting the minority's rights to influence the government, if both parties no longer feel some fealty towards the norms that made these institutions function, where does that end?
It's a great question. And it's something, I wrestled with when I was writing this book. I do think that the Merrick Garland theft was a much more serious escalation than we think. I mean, it's not just about the sling seat on the court. Neil Gorsuch is illegitimate in my mind, and there's no question about it. But if you think about the underlying norms about how Supreme Court appointments get made, they're already gone. you know, and the Republicans prior to the election, when they thought that they were going to lose, made these noises. John McCain and Ted Cruz went out and talked about how they, if they controlled the Senate and Hillary Clinton won the election, they weren't going to let her fill a Supreme Court seat. And so I think that the other side is already deeply radicalized. There are plans floating around the sort of right-wing judicial universe, very similar to what I'm proposing in this book, and they are not by fringe figures. One of those articles is by Steve Calabresi, who's one of the sort of intellectual fathers of the originalism movement. There's articles out there about jurisdiction stripping, which would be Congress passing a law depriving the Supreme Court of its ability to rule on certain issues. And I think, frankly, that the entire architecture of judicial review is in jeopardy based on the increasing radicalization of the right. So I am concerned about retaliation in the future. I think one of the ways that Democrats can describe what they're doing when they do this is to offer an olive branch. They say, okay, instead of packing the courts, we could do this other thing. And that would be passing a constitutional amendment to end lifetime tenure on the Supreme Court and in the federal courts more broadly. There's also a law that I talk about in the book called crafted by this organization, Fix the Court, that would routinize appointments to the Supreme Court without a constitutional amendment. Whether that would stand up to court scrutiny, we don't know. But I think if Democrats pitched it as like, look, we're the ones that actually want to take the partisan temperature down. We want to end these destructive partisan battles over court appointments by more explicitly spelling out the constitutional language about how they get made and when they get made, how many appointments each president is entitled to, rather than it being what it is now, which is a lottery. We say each president gets to appoint two justices in every 4-year term. People leave after 18 years, so we don't have to appoint these like Doogie Howses to the court anymore. We can go with people in their late 50s and early 60s. Who might not have 30 years in them, but might be a better choice in terms of their underlying abilities. So, of course, yeah, I'm concerned about retaliation. I think that there are ways of presenting the move as you made us do this because you won't do this other thing. And at the end of the day, I'm pretty convinced that we're not that far away from the right choosing to do some of these things first. And the last thing I would like to see is that the Democrats maintain this commitment to institutionalism and pragmatism, and then once again get outflanked by this escalation from the right.
I think one thing that's inspiring conservatives to do all of these things is a sense of both that they're facing demographic headwinds, that they may not, that their core coalition, which according to Alan Abramowitz is married white people who identify as Christians is rapidly shrinking. I don't buy the demographics as destiny argument, but the demographics certainly as a coming advantage is something that I think is pretty clearly recognized by both sides. And then the other thing is that they know that the policy preferences that they advance tend to not be popular. So do you think that Democrats have failed to fight fire with fire because of these things? Do you think that they've kind of told themselves, well, you know, young people skew our way and we have this growing Latino vote and they're skewing our way, Asian American vote as well, and our policies are popular and that's why they haven't fought back in the same way?
I think that's it does have something to do with that. Yeah, I mean, I think there's been a little bit too much belief in the sort of long-term demographic trends. If you remember Roy Teixeira's book, The Emerging Democratic Majority, from 2002, and so that's, you know, that was 16 years ago, and things have not exactly worked out as we thought they would. You know, one of the problems is that, you know, 100% of the population doesn't vote. We don't know that much about those folks. And so when a few more of them come out to vote, as they did in 2016, it can really upend these demographic expectations. I think in the long run, the Republicans have a demographic problem in a variety of ways. I think one that gets talked about a little bit less is the way that millennials are skewing so, so heavily towards Democrats. If you look at the data from when we started tracking this in 2004, Democrats have enjoyed about a 20-point advantage on partisan ID with millennials, who are now the largest living generation. And as much as we like to romanticize young people and think that they always leaned left, they didn't. You know, young people voted for Reagan. Young people voted for Nixon. And this is unprecedented. I mean, this is really unprecedented for this enormous block of young people, an entire generation, to be skewing in the Democrats' favor by this large of a gap. And so I think that there is maybe, at least prior to 2016, there was a sense that, okay, well, demography is on our side, and surely the American people will punish the Republicans for the way they've been behaving over the last 8 years. And that just didn't happen. You know, that was one of the most depressing things to me about the 2016 election is I also had the sense that surely like right will win out here, you know, that like, people will look at what Republicans have done in office and this obstructionism and the destruction of norms and threatening America's credit in the world. And they will vote them out of office. And they didn't do that. And so I think that we can't afford to wait for these demographic trends to fully vest. You know, I don't know that enough sort of elderly white Republicans are going to die in the next 3 years to really give us a lasting majority. I think that we need to get a bit more creative in addition to exploiting those demographic trends. We need to get creative about our procedural warfare.
And the other thing, as you point out so well, is that, you know, we don't know where the end to these anti-democratic policies might be. So, you know, just recently we see this introduction of a citizenship question into the census. It is yet another creative way of gaming the system in a way that advantages Republicans. And I'm seeing people who are, you know, very savvy about these things debating by what margin Democrats need to win the popular vote in order to secure a majority in the House of Representatives. It should be 50% plus one vote. And yet we're hearing anything from between, they need to win anywhere between four and 12 percentage points to actually win the House. And this is just, it's maddening. It's maddeningly undemocratic. I would say that everything that you say in the book can be framed as a pro small d democracy agenda. And I think it's really important that Democrats pursue this.
Yeah, and that's a great point. I mean, it's some of the ways that our procedures lead to undemocratic outcomes are really outrageous. You know, for the House, I'm thinking of 2012, you know, when we won the popular vote, we had a minority. And I just don't think that we can continue to assume that the policies and the sort of underlying rightness of our cause is going to be enough to overcome these structural barriers, because so far they haven't been. And I think one of the big, big advantages of doing some of these things would be that they will put us in a much, much better position for the 2022 midterms. If we are able, knock on wood, to take power in 2020 with the presidency and Congress, I think, you know, restoring voting rights for all these folks and the election holiday and really passing a law that makes House results fairer makes it much, much less likely that we're just going to turn power right back over to these guys in 2022 like we did last time. Because the reality is that the trajectory of the Republican Party right now is so dangerous, it's so destructive that I really, really believe that Democrats need to win 3, 4, 5 national elections in a row in order to bring this country back onto the track that it needs to be.
Yeah, I think you're right, and I think that it's important that I think that the best hope for a silver lining in Trump is that his victory in the Electoral College, along with events like the theft of the Supreme Court, are finally opening people's eyes up to the fact that, you know, it is good to have civility and bipartisanship and all of that in the abstract. But when you get down to where the rubber meets the road, you know, we have to exercise power if we want to maintain our values. And that those values include pluralistic liberal democracy, small d democratic values. David Farris, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
It was a pleasure, Josh. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Folks, the book is titled It's Time to Fight Dirty, How Democrats Can Build a Lasting Majority in American Politics. Check it out. Stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back.
Why do my thoughts bloom so large on me? They seem to stay for day after day and won't disappear. I've tried every way, but she smiles sweetly. She smiles sweetly. She smiles sweetly and says, "Don't worry." Most every day and won't disappear. My hair's turning gray, but she smiles sweetly. She smiles sweetly. She smiles sweetly and says, "Don't worry."
Show. I'm still Joshua Holland. I'm joined now by Evan Weber. He's a co-founder of the Sunrise Movement, and I wanted to bring him on to talk about a project that they're working on that has potential to be one of the many kind of, you know, I've been looking for silver linings in Trumpism, and the one potential silver lining that we've talked about on the show before, of course, is this explosion of new grassroots activism energy on the left. So this may be part of that. Evan, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thank you very much, Joshua. Happy to be here.
So can you tell me a little bit about what you're doing? What is the Sunrise Movement?
Sure. Well, Sunrise Movement is an emerging movement to stop climate change and create millions of good jobs in the process. And we are building an army of young people to make climate change an urgent priority across this country, to end the corrupting influence of fossil fuel executives on our politics, and importantly, to this year, to elect leaders who actually stand up for the health and well-being of all of us, not just fossil fuel billionaires and the 1%.
And you're trying to raise some funds right now for a specific project. Tell me a little bit about that.
Sure. So this year, we are hoping to have a major intervention in the midterm elections to make climate change actually matter in our elections and politics for the first time in many places. And so we're doing that by energizing the youth climate base that helped to defeat the Keystone XL pipeline, standing shoulder to shoulder with indigenous and frontline communities, that divested billions of dollars from campus endowments from the fossil fuel industry, and taking all of that energy and channeling it towards electoral politics and actually getting young people who care about climate change to move off of their campuses and start engaging with with the actual political system. And what we're doing is running a program. Again, we're called Sunrise Movement. And so we're running a program called Sunrise Semester that's going to run from June through November of 2018. And will be an opportunity for young people who care about the environment and care about politics to really make a difference in this political moment where they're really feeling the weight of the world and want to be able to drop everything to take action. And so for some of them, it might be, taking a gap year from high school to college. For others, it might be taking a semester off from school. For others, maybe it'll be dropping their job for a little while. And if they're willing to take that leap and take that commitment, we want to be able to support them. And we're building out movement houses across 5 states where organizers will be placed working in key districts. Some of them will be from those districts. Some of them will be from outside, and they'll really be working to expose the role that big oil plays in corrupting our democracy and campaign directly for politicians who are actually going to represent our values.
And these young people, they're not looking for a salary, right? They're basically going to volunteer, and you're just looking to cover their living expenses. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. Nobody is in this for a job. It's not necessarily a career development opportunity, although, it will be a huge leadership development experience, and they'll gain a ton of experience. But what this is really about is young people with passion, who care about this political moment, who are really willing to make sacrifice and a big commitment. And so, yeah, we're raising money to be able to support them. We're aiming to have 100 across these 5 states. And right now we've got 45 committed, another 32 qualified applicants in the wings that, if we can raise some more funds, we'll be able to accept. And we're pretty confident that we can recruit the remainder before the program starts on June 4th.
You know the right conservatives have invested an enormous amount in kind of training and mentoring young people on campuses, off campuses. There are a lot of internship programs, places like the Heritage Foundation, etc. It's important to provide these things for people on the left as well in terms of thinking of the long view. And I think that one thing that progressives have had a problem with, or an imbalance, I should say, is that I think that conservatives play the long game better than progressives do. I mean, we tend to think about the next election or, advancing a piece of legislation or defeating a piece of legislation. And what conservative donors will do is they'll just put a bunch of money into some young people doing something and, we'll see how it shakes out. But in the meantime, they're developing a bench for the future. They're developing people who are who have an activist bent, who are involved and engaged and doing things in their community. And that is a long-term investment that pays off in ways that we can't necessarily quantify. There's this whole thing in the nonprofit world, can I show you results? You can't always show results for long-term movement building until years down the road and in a diffuse way. Can I ask you, what was your background? I mean, how did this Sunrise Movement come to be? Was it post Trump's election?
Yeah, happy to share. So a group of us got together actually before the 2016 election in the summer of 2016 that had been organizers across different areas of the youth climate movement. Some of us were working to fight fracking and stop pipelines. Others were building campaigns and organizations to divest college campuses from fossil fuels. Myself, I was working on helping to build statewide networks of young people to call for bolder government action on climate change. And we all came together because we realized that the work that we were doing was good work. It was, you know, supporting young people to get involved. We were getting media attention and things like that. But we really felt like it wasn't enough, and we knew that looking at the history of successful social movements and, you know, successful social movements from our contemporaries, that the climate movement could be doing a lot more to reach people at scale and really speak to this issue as a moral crisis that that could get people involved. And one of the things that inspired us a lot was seeing the rise of the Bernie Sanders campaign in 2016 as well, and seeing how this old Jewish man, independent senator from Vermont, was inspiring all of these Generation Z folks who had never been involved in social movements, never been involved in activism, to join this political revolution. And a big part of his message was, you know, taking on the fossil fuel billionaires and really having an unapologetic, bold, progressive vision. And that really inspired us to believe that that it was possible to build something bigger than what we were currently doing. And so we were in this planning process, and then, of course, the election happened. And, you know, that, I think, changed the landscape for all of us doing this work across the progressive movement. But, you know, for us, we were really able to sort of absorb the impact of that into our strategy. And we put out a four-year strategy that really shows how we believe that our movement can help build power to win climate action at the scale that we need. And if you're interested, you can go and check it out on our website, sunrisemovement.org, and learn more about it there. But that, you know, when we launched with that in the summer of 2017, so many people were excited to join us because so much of the environmental movement and the climate movement didn't have a plan for this new political landscape. And so we're offering that, and this Sunrise Semester program is a really big part of our strategy. But like you said, it is about the long vision, and 2018 is really just the beginning. And if we're able to be successful this year, which of course, you know, a big part of it is if we're able to raise these funds to accept these fellows, then we can really do it even bigger in 2020 and continue to build that leadership development pipeline that the progressive movement so desperately needs.
Folks, listen, if Evan was were organizing a group of conservative youth to oppose, you know, emissions regulations or something like that, he'd be swimming in Koch brothers' money. They need $90,000 in the next couple of weeks. They're looking for $170,000 overall. It's not a huge ask. Kick in a few bucks if you can afford it. It's you can go to sunrisemovement.org/donate. It's right there on the homepage. I'm going to give a donation to this group today after I complete the show. And I think that you should consider giving to them as well. Again, we need to invest in the long run. It is important that we, you know, send those $20 pledges to candidates we like, progressive candidates we like. It is important that we put money into the midterms if we can afford it. Let's be clear, if you can't afford it, you can volunteer, you can do phone banking, you can do other things. But if you can afford it, you need to spend money on candidates, but you also need to spend money thinking long term in terms of developing a bench, in terms of training young people into how to engage. Again, it's sunrisemovement.org/donate. Check it out. Evan Weber, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back. We welcome back. Again, this interview with Jeffrey Swanson was recorded last year after the Las Vegas massacre, the worst mass shooting in American history. Still relevant today, unfortunately. We still don't have a complete picture of what motivated Stephen Paddock, the Las Vegas shooter. We're learning more about him. ABC reported that, and I quote, his mental state was deteriorating in the weeks before the shooting, and he'd shown significant weight loss, an increasingly slovenly physical appearance, and an obsession with his girlfriend's ex-husband. According to the Los Angeles Times, he was known for berating his girlfriend in public. That's what folks at the local Starbucks say. A former neighbor called him, and I quote, aggressively unfriendly. And we also know that he had 47 guns. He'd bought 33 of them over the previous year, according to George Zornick, my colleague at The Nation. And here's an interesting fact about gun ownership in the United States. According to the Washington Post, 78% of American adults don't own a gun. Then 19% own half of all the private firearms in the country. And then there's this group, just 3%. 3% of American adults own the other half. And that last group, they own an average of 17 guns each. Presumably they only have two hands, right? But they have 17 guns. And of course, some are collectors. It's benign, right? People collect postage stamps or whatever. But a decent number of these people are just hoarding guns, hoarding, buying more and more guns, more and more ammo. And all of this made me think about a fascinating study that was published in 2015 in the journal Behavioral Sciences and the Law. It was the first study to look at a population of gun owners who also have a tendency toward angry and impulsive behavior. I'm very pleased to have the lead author of that study on this week's show. Jeffrey Swanson is a professor of psychiatry at Duke University. Professor Swanson, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for taking the time. And let's make it clear up front that we're not necessarily talking about Stephen Paddock. We still don't know enough about him, but we could be. So to begin with, can you tell us a little bit about the kind of key findings in your study, and then we can drill down a bit?
Sure. We were looking for the prevalence of two kinds of things that come together in the adult population in the United States. Number one is impulsive, angry behavior. These are the kinds of people who, when they get angry, they break and smash things, get into physical fights, that kind of person with a short fuse. And number two, access to firearms, which we think is a bad combination. And we wanted to know how many people are there like that out there in the adult population. And we used a national survey database to estimate that.
And you found that number was 8.9% of your of your study group. So we're talking about potentially around 22 million people who have this rather disturbing combination. Now, the thing that made me recall your study, which I wrote briefly about when it was first published, is that there's this subgroup of gun owners that have many weapons and who carry weapons with them, and they're more likely to exhibit these traits that put them at higher risk of violence than people who have access to a firearm maybe in their home, or maybe have access to one or two guns, but not 17 guns. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's right. So if you think about a huge crowd of 100,000 people crammed into a big space. Now, in that group, about 9,000, you know, almost 1 in 10, are going to have access to firearms somewhere, in the sense that they might have them at home and they have these problematic anger problems. There's a subgroup that is almost 1,500, we would estimate. 1488 is probably not that precise, but think of that number in the crowd, who have these impulsive anger problems and they're carrying a gun with them. That might even be higher now, because the data were collected was some years ago, and since that time there's been a real expansion in concealed carry, and it could be, particularly in some areas of the country, it would be more than that. But that group of people, as you suggested, that problematic combination of being a an angry gun carrier is more likely in people who own multiple guns. 6 to 10 or more than that, it is significantly more likely in that group that they're going to have that combination.
A number of journalists have made a connection between mass shooters and domestic violence. At least anecdotally, a lot of these people who commit these mass shootings had a history of abusing spouses or other loved ones. Is that observation something that's supported in the empirical literature?
Well, let me answer it not by talking about mass shooters, but by saying that the best predictor of interpersonal violence, serious interpersonal violence, is prior violence. That doesn't explain why people are violent in the first place, but if you just want to predict it, prior violence is a better predictor, say, than mental illness is. And violence does escalate. You know, the way I might put it is, today's fist and black eye too often becomes tomorrow's gun and dead body, which is why I and other members of the Consortium for Risk-Based Firearms Policy think that violent misdemeanors should be added to the list of people who should be prohibited from buying a firearm. Many states allow people with a misdemeanor violent crime conviction to purchase a gun. Some states like California don't, and they tend to have lower violence rates.
If you're just tuning in, this is Politics and Reality Radio, and I'm speaking with Jeffrey Swanson from Duke University. What other characteristics did you find were typical? By the way, I do want to get back, before I let you go, to policy issues. I'm not going to let you go without talking about that a little bit. But in terms of this study, what other characteristics did you find were not typical, but were there demographic trends within this group of people who have impulsive anger issues and easy access to a firearm?
Well, it tended to be men, younger individuals, but I think one of the important findings was sort of an answer to the question, are these individuals mentally ill? Because that always comes up, you know, is someone like this, is this, the act of an unhealthy mind? And we did find that many of these individuals would meet criteria for some kind of psychopathology, but it didn't tend to be the kinds of things like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, the sorts of disorders that characterize populations that are involuntarily committed and would thereby lose their gun rights under the federal law with that kind of rule. Instead, they were things like personality disorders and alcohol problems, anxiety, intermittent explosive disorder. And fewer than 10% of them had ever been in a hospital for treatment of a mental health or a substance abuse problem. So I think this is an example of a group of individuals who, when we say the rules that we have for denying a gun purchase of people who are risky are both under and over inclusive. They're overbroad and they're also too narrow in some sense. This is an example of people who are not captured by that kind of policy.
What do you mean by overbroad and too narrow? Can you expand on that just a little bit?
Well, sure. Here's an example. There's a man by the name of Charles Tyler who lived in Michigan, and about 25 years ago, he had a brief involuntary commitment because of a kind of reactive depression. For the next 25 years, he had no problems with mental illness. He wasn't treated for depression or substance abuse problems. He had a job. He was a model citizen. Now he decided after those decades to purchase a firearm, and he was denied because his name was in the National Instant Criminal Background Check System because of that gun disqualifying involuntary commitment 25 years ago. And he sued, and because there was no opportunity in Michigan for him to get his gun rights back. Because the premise of that was that, if you have been mentally ill ever and involuntarily committed, that's a proxy for dangerousness forever. And it really isn't. And the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals that heard that case, it's a little complicated, but basically agreed with him. So that's an example where the rule about, history of involuntary commitment might be overbroad. It might capture lots of people with mental illness who aren't violent and maybe never will be. But the example on the other side of it being too narrow, take the example of Craig Stephen Hicks, who was a very angry man in my hometown in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, who shot and killed three North Carolina Muslim young people in the head. And people knew he was angry. People were scared of him. He had guns, but there was nothing really anybody could do. He owned those guns legally. Now, this is an example, I think, where a policy such as a risk-based temporary civil court order to remove guns from risky people, as a number of states now have this law, would have been a good idea, because people could have, who had that information could have let the police know, and if they had the clear legal authority to do so, they could have at least removed his guns.
This is really fascinating, and I think that it kind of is in keeping with a broader social phenomenon of stigmatizing the mentally ill. I mean, the reality is that mentally ill people are not, as a group, more likely to be violent than the population as a whole. Is that right?
Yeah, that's more or less right. I mean, they're a little bit more likely in terms of relative risk. And the attributable risk, which means what it was the proportion of all the violence out there that we could say is attributable to mental illness, is about 4%. So if we cured mental illness, our overall violence problem would go down by 4%. 96% of it would still be there. But I would say this, about the mass shootings, they are horrible, as you said. I mean, they're so disturbing. They're so irrational. They're everything we don't want ordinary life to be. We want our lives to be safe and to make sense, and they're none of those things. And so we focus on it, and we demand an answer. Why did this happen? And I think naturally people point to mental illness because they think, someone who goes out and massacres a bunch of strangers, that's not the act of a healthy mind. That person must be really, really disturbed. And I would say, that's true. You don't have to be a psychiatry professor to say there's something wrong there.
Of course.
But it doesn't mean that they have schizophrenia. And the other thing is, on that very day that all these people died, probably 100 other people died in the United States as a result of a gunshot. Many of those were arguments gone bad, where maybe in another country, two, angry, impulsive, intoxicated young men in the middle of the night get in an argument over somebody's girlfriend and somebody gets a black eye. In our country, it's more likely, statistically more likely, that somebody will have a handgun and there will be a dead body. That's embedded in our homicide rates. But we don't hear about those people. That's the unmentioned kind of quotidian, everyday, ordinary gun toll in our country.
And I think this is such a key point that people need to understand. We're talking about aggressive, impulsive behavior, and that is not necessarily a diagnosable mental illness that would lead you to be involuntarily committed or lose your right to buy a gun. So we have the screening system set up, and we're not talking about people who would necessarily be flagged if we just had more or better mental health screening, right?
Well, that's true. That's true. I mean, there are some things we could do. We could have better criteria. And the criteria we have now, which date back to the 1968 Gun Control Act, aren't necessarily very strongly correlated with behavioral indicators of risk. So we could improve that. We'd also, have
how
comprehensive background check system.
Talk a little bit about how we could improve that.
Well, states could do this. It's kind of difficult at the federal level because, as I like to say, the whole topic of guns and gun control is kind of radioactive.
Yes.
But at the state level, there's a lot that's happening and can happen. And I think, citizens have probably a better chance of influencing their local lawmakers. So a state can have a rule that goes beyond what the federal rule does. And so they can have, for example, a set of prohibiting characteristics in the background check system that work for that state. So the one I gave you before is a state has all these records of violent misdemeanors. Some states report those to the NICS and somebody can't buy a gun. Other states don't. Another example would be, people who are brought into an emergency room in a hospital in a mental health crisis, and they have a brief involuntary hospitalization for an evaluation, and a doctor certifies that they are posing a danger to themselves or others, but many times that doesn't progress to a gun disqualifying involuntary commitment hearing where someone would actually meet the definition in federal law. But the system knows that person's at risk, and some states would say, well, let's use that proxy indicator and prohibit those individuals from having a firearm for a period of time. Those records exist too. We found in our study in Florida that in a big population of psychiatric patients, that among the gun suicides, 72% of those individuals were legally eligible to buy a gun on the day they used one to end their life. And half of those, though, had had a history of a short-term involuntary hold under the Baker Act. What if those individuals had not been able to buy a gun? And some people go out and buy a gun specifically because they're in that moment of despair. And, you know, at that moment when someone is feeling so hopeless and so so low that they are inclined to hurt themselves, and then that impulsive act to do that, you know, if they try that and they have anything else but a gun, they're very likely to survive.
Right.
If they have a firearm, they're highly unlikely to survive. So that's an important public health opportunity.
Are there any other policy implications from your research?
Well, you know, I think the gun violence prevention in our country is like a jigsaw puzzle with a couple pieces hidden under the rug, which means it's difficult, but it's not impossible. And we could start, the point of purchase is an important one. We could make that work better. It would work way better if, in addition to that, we had universal background checks so that, you know, if a state just does that by themselves, that might work. But what happens is the neighboring state that doesn't have background checks imports guns across the state line. So that's another thing. Then we could have, you know, these preemptive temporary gun removal laws. It's a civil court order. It's non-criminalizing. And that takes care of the problem of the fact that, you know, if you just stop someone from buying a new gun, it doesn't do anything to protect people from the 12 guns they may already have at home. But this removal law, which is risk-based, would address that. And then, you know, I think things like making sure that people have to get a permit and that we do something to try to beef up enforcement of our laws against illegal gun trafficking. This is difficult in our country because guns and private gun ownership is culturally entrenched. It's highly prevalent. It's constitutionally protected. Guns are not going away. We love guns in this country. We have a heck of a lot of them.
Yes.
So we have to do something difficult, try to figure out who are the dangerous people who are so dangerous that it's justified to limit a constitutional right. And that's our struggle. Other countries don't necessarily have to make it so difficult for themselves. They say it's just too dangerous for somebody to carry a handgun around all the time.
Right. Jeffrey Swanson, I believe we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. I really do appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks for doing the show.
I'd also like to thank David Ferris and Evan Weber. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show at iTunes or Podbean or SoundCloud, wherever else you can find it. You can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. I'd like to thank the good folks at Crooks and Liars, Hullabaloo, and Smirking Chimp for letting me host the show at their respective joints. Of course, I would like to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.